Welcome to the Self-Publishing School Podcast. This is the podcast to listen to if you're an aspiring writer or an author who wants to be more successful. On this show, you'll learn how to write and launch a book successfully, all from the top authors and people just like you who are doing it at the highest level. I'm your host, Chandler Volt, the founder of Self-Publishing School, the author of the book called Published, and the CEO of selfpublishing.com. For free training on how to publish a book that sells 10,000 copies, go to selfpublishing.com/free training. Hey, Chandler Bolt here, and joining me today is Tim Wagner. Tim's first novel came out in 2001, and he's published close to, get this, 50 novels and seven collections of short stories since. He writes original fantasy and horror, as well as media tie-ins. His novels include Like Death, which is considered a modern classic in the genre, and the popular Necropolis series of urban fantasy novels. He's also written tie-in fiction, which we're going to talk a little bit about that, for Supernatural, Alien, Grimm, The X-Files, Doctor Who, and A Nightmare on Elm Street, Transformers, among others. Today, we're going to be talking, I mean, obviously all things fiction. So a lot of things about writing habits, writing practice, what writing in the dark, what is it? What does it mean? We're going to talk about fiction marketing, tie-ins, tie-in books. What are they? There's a lot of things for us to cover. So Tim, welcome. Great to have you here.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I guess let's start with this. Why books? Why are you so passionate about writing great fiction?
Probably because I just grew up as a reader. Nothing really stimulates my imagination more. You know, there was a time when TV kind of took over and I didn't read for a little while, like around junior high or so. But my dad was a big reader and he'd always have books lying around. And sometimes he'd say, you might like this one, Tim, try this out. So, you know, in a way, it was kind of like a way to kind of get to know him and be a little closer to him. But you know, I found that there was just a lot more depth. He got into the characters' heads that you could do, especially back when I was a kid, not a lot of budget for special effects. And the special effects were not special back then compared to now. So you could have like all kinds of amazing things going on in a book that you couldn't do in a movie or a TV show. And so that just kind of pulled me into it and been there ever since.
Why did you decide to write your first book? Was there anything that kind of sparked that?
I was just like a lot of creative people. If you love something, you just want to be a part of it so much that you want to like kind of get inside it. And, you know, creating, it's a way to do that. And so when I was in junior high, I did start to do like my little homemade comic book that I featured my friends and myself as superheroes because I figured at least they would read it if it was about them. So some people to read it. And, you know, I just enjoyed that so much that over time, I started writing stories. I wanted to be an artist for a little while till I realized I could say more faster with words than I could drawing. And it just kept going from there. I just fell in love with it. Started reading Writer's Digest magazine and interviews with writers and articles on the craft of it. And I just fell in love with the whole thing. So I finished my first novel at 19 and wasn't that great. but I did do it. So I accomplished it. And even though I like writing short stories, I really like the complexity of books. I like the way that you have these different elements and you can tie them together as you go. I like the fact that you can show things from different characters' perspectives when you can't quite do that in a short story because there's not a lot of room. Mm-hmm. So I just really enjoy the novel form.
Nice. So first, you said you wrote the first book at 19. Did that book get published?
Oh, no. There was no self-publishing like there is now. Yeah. You know, I was born in 1964, so 19 was probably 1983, I think. And, you know, I would have like uploaded that thing in 19. I would have been like uploaded that thing immediately. So I've been so enthusiastic about it. You know, I'm not unhappy that those trunk novels didn't get published because I wrote a few others that didn't. But they were really great experiences. You know, I learned a lot from them. I still think of those stories fondly. But yeah, it's not something I'd ever really want to share with anybody at this point.
So what age were you when you ended up publishing your first book, and what sparked getting the first one published?
I probably 36 maybe, because I had published a whole lot of short fiction at that point, and I'd written novels, and you know, I had agents sending them around, and just none of them had landed yet. The first one was, it's just a weird situation. I had collaborated with a writer on a short story for an anthology about Xena the Warrior Princess. He was having trouble coming up with a story, and the editor recommended me as a co-writer with him. We wrote it together. It was fun. And when it was done, he's like, you know, I'm an editor too, so if anything ever comes up, I'll get in touch with you. And I'm like, oh, that's nice. You know, I didn't know if anything would come of it. And then he somehow ended up in this company called Foggy Windows, which was erotica for married couples. So it was very, very niche audience. And he's like, do you want to write one of these books for me? And I was like, it's not the kind of thing I ever thought about doing, but okay. And, you know, plus I kind of have a, it's not exactly a rule, but if I ever feel like I'm above a certain kind of writing, I always make sure to say, no, don't think that way. You're not too good for anything. At least explore it. So he wanted me to pitch him an erotic mystery. And it was about a husband and wife, a private investigator team that had trouble keeping their hands off each other during cases. And I couldn't take it seriously. So I also made it a comedy. And I called it Dying for It because there was like a death in the, you know, in the mystery. And I tried my best to, you know, I wrote a good story. I wrote good characters. You know, they mandated so many sex scenes, but I made sure every single one had either showed something about character, advanced the plot. And then the company published 5 books. You know, mine was one of them, and then went under. So, well, my book came out, but I've never done anything since like it. But so yeah, that technically is the very first, not the first one I wrote by any means, but it's the first one that got published.
Yeah. So I guess 2-part question. How, well, you just kind of explained how you finally got published. Any lessons learned from that kind of window? And obviously, you know, it strikes me as, okay, 19 to 36, 18 years. And then similarly, there's been another batch of your life of, you know, I guess 20 something years where you've written and published 50 books. Like, knowing what you know now, would there be any advice that you'd give to that 19 year old self, or kind of that, like that in between before you got the first one published?
Yeah, you know, there's a couple different ways I could have gone. You know, one thing that I learned from this is that if a weird opportunity presents itself, give it a shot or at least explore it. I've talked to a lot of writers over the years, and many of them were like, oh yeah, I never thought about writing mysteries, but I just kind of fell into it. Now I'm rich and famous as a mystery writer. And, you know, if people weren't willing to at least, you know, look outside what they thought was their specialty, that wouldn't happen. I've known people that have gotten published in nonfiction and had great careers when they thought they'd be fiction writers, and vice versa. People that have reinvented themselves as the years go by. So being just open to all kinds of things and trying them just to see what happens. The other thing, it's kind of opposite, but the other thing was that I did try a lot of different things, and it might have worked better if I had focused more on one type of fiction early on. Back then when I started, was the 80s horror boom was in full swing, and I liked horror fiction just fine. I loved it. But at the time, you know, reading articles and stuff, they're like, oh, you know, pick something long lasting, whatever. And I'm like, well, I write fantasy. That's what I'm into now. And so I completely missed that horror boom, which, since there was such a demand, I probably would have been able to publish novels then and get started publishing a little bit sooner. So it's kind of like 2 different opposite things, but you can also do all of it. You know, I could have focused on horror, but then when this weird thing came along later with erotic mysteries, I could say, sure, I'll give that a shot and see what happens. Yeah. So I think it's not literally movement, but it's like movement, that you keep moving and keep trying different things. Don't necessarily pigeonhole yourself. And if there's something you're afraid to try it anyway. I loved horror so much that I was kind of afraid I'd mess it up. So I was sort of afraid to try it until eventually it just, that's where most of my success came from. So I just kept following it that way. Cool. So I tell people, keep moving, keep trying different things.
Mm-hmm. And so you, so having the very first experience writing that erotica book, that was kind of, it sounds like, all right, hey, write this. That it was very, I guess, dictated in a way. And all right, there's mandates on certain stuff. Anything that you learned from that experience, like doing that kind of, it sounds like all your writing now is just wildly different. So was there anything that you learned that carried over?
Well, when you have a certain set of circumstances, I mean, you can already have sort of, you know, very fuzzy and kind of soft guidelines within a genre. And you got a lot of room for creativity, but like with a romance category romance novel, if you don't have a, you know, happy ending, the fans are going to revolt because that's like the thing that they're looking for in that. But because there were specific things I had to do, it primed me for doing more media tie-in stuff where you do have certain things you can and can't do. And especially if you're working with established characters, you know, like Sam and Dean and Supernatural, there's only so much you can do with them. And so it kind of shows you how to work with limitations in a way. Long time ago, I saw an interview with Katie Lang back when she was still a country singer before she moved on to be a pop star. And somebody asked her, why country? You don't seem like, you know, the stereotypical country, you know, what people imagine a country singer is. And she said that she liked seeing what she could do with those limitations. You know, here's what a country song is supposed to be. And then you can play off that. It's almost like having resistance in an exercise or having a wall to bounce a ball off of. Sometimes you need something to work with, and it can really be in its own way. It sounds very constricting, but it can also be very freeing because it gives you a chance to try different, like, you know, creative muscles you might not have tried before. And it forces you to think in different ways, which I find pretty valuable.
That makes sense. And so let's maybe zoom out just a little bit on, you know, the last 20 years or so, you've written 50 books.
Well, some of those were written beforehand and then got published eventually, but I've written a lot of books in the last 20 years.
Yeah. So how have you done that? I mean, let's call it 20 years and some change, 50 books. How did you do it? And what are some of the biggest lessons learned?
Well, you know, sometimes it depends on the length of the book too. So some books will be, you know, 70,000 words, some might be 120. So that helps. And they're still called separate books, but the length can make a difference. Sometimes it's just because, especially with tie-ins, you know, you might get an opportunity to pitch for a project, you pitch for it, they like it, and then they're like, it's due in 3 months. So you just do it. Meet that those kind of deadlines, you just don't take those kind of gigs. But luckily, I'm a fast writer. I spend a lot of time kind of visualizing my stories and thinking about them before I sit down to write. So when I write, it looks like I write really fast, but the overall process could take a while. I can also like kind of think about different projects at the same time before I sit down to write maybe one. I might be thinking of another one in some level. So all that helps. But some people, you know, they need to go slower, and there's nothing wrong with that. You should do whatever produces your best work, or lean into your strengths. You know, if you can find out that, you know, I may not be the world's greatest prose stylist, but I can write pretty fast. And then you're like, okay, that's a strength I'll lean into. Or, you know, I can't write fast, but man, I write really beautiful sentences. Then you lean into that. And don't let other people tell you that, you know, real writers do this, that, or the other thing, because there are no unreal writers. We're all real writers, you know, in any way that we approach it that works for us is fine.
Mm-hmm. Got it. How do you feel like your writing process has evolved over the books?
Yeah, you know, I used to be more of a strict outliner, and I wouldn't have like every single beat written down or anything like that, but I'd have an outline and I mostly follow it. With tie-in books, you still need to do that because it's approved by the studio or whoever owns the IP. And so they are expecting a story that's pretty much the outline you turned in. But for my own stuff, you know, I may have an outline, you know, I'll sell the book on the outline and it's time to sit down and write it. And I may not look at the outline again. You know, I have the story in my head, but I'm not worried about whether it matches the outline 100%. And that works pretty well for me. But often I don't know what's going to happen until the next book, because it's like each time you almost have to reinvent the process because you've never written that book before. So you got to find a process for that particular one. But I find myself either outlining less or not referring to the outlines as much as I used to.
Oh, interesting. And why do you think that is? Is that just the muscle that's been built? Is it, you think, a style change, something else?
Yeah, no, I think it really is the fact that you get used to the idea of how to construct a scene, how to end a scene, when's a good idea to switch to somebody else's point of view, how to build suspense, how to do that. It's like, you know, if you learned how to play tennis, eventually you're not thinking about all the separate moves you're doing. You're thinking at a higher level because they're all in your muscle memory. So I think it's more like that. You know, it's in my creative memory.
Hey, Chandler Bolt here. I hope you're loving this episode so far. It's time to go from inspiration to implementation. All right, so if you've learned something, we want to help you implement what you've learned with your book. So what I want you to do right now is go to selfpublishing.com/schedule, book a publishing consultation with one of the experts on my team. We'll talk about your goals for your book, your dreams, your challenges, your next steps, and we'll start putting together a plan. All right, so go to selfpublishing.com/schedule, book a call with the team. Let's see how we can help with your book. It's time to implement. So I guess with that in mind, I mean, I know there's no one size fits all, but do you recommend that early writers start more as plotters and then kind of earn your way into the ability to be a pantser, or is that more just what worked for you?
It's more than what worked for me, because some of my early novels, not my first three, they were shorter. I mean, they were all like over 200 pages, but I just finished those. But then I started becoming aware of this thing called revising. I was like, okay, I want to make my books the best they could be. And what I would find is I would make different choices along the way and figure, oh, I'll go back and fix and make everything work later. And it became a huge mess for me to deal with. And those books I never finished. Or if I finished them, they were a mess that needed revision that I just didn't do. It seemed overwhelming to me. And so eventually I got to a point where I was able to kind of learn to revise as I went, which helped a lot. I think that for beginning writers, try all of it and see, you know, I tell people what gives you your creative energy. Some people, they loathe writing a first draft, but they cannot wait to rewrite it. I don't understand people that think revision is fun, because it's not my mindset. I love to create something. So, but I know that I had to learn, you know, at least how to revise well enough, or how to revise in a way that actually kind of works with my strength in creating. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my story files or a book file, one file, I can sweep back and forth at any time. If I suddenly realize I need to make a change, I just zip back, and then I can zip forward. And it's still part of the creative process. And by the time I'm done, there still may be some revision to do, but I've done a lot of it. So what looks like my first draft isn't, but it also is a draft that's pretty ready to go. So I just found my way to do it. So I would say just try as many different things as you can, but don't ever listen to anybody tells you have to do something a certain way, because it's not true. There's a million ways to do stuff, and you may do the different way each time you sit down to work.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Now you keep talking about this or keep mentioning this concept of the media tie-in books. I have no experience with this. I didn't even know what they are, and I hadn't even heard of them until I was doing research for this interview. So can you tell me and us what's a media tie-in book?
Sure, you know what they are because you've seen them. It's like if you've ever seen Star Wars books or Star Trek books, those are media tie-ins. So it is a different kind of media. So it's not going to be like a book. It'll be a TV show, a comic book, a movie, a video game, board game, whatever, some kind of a toy. It'll be some kind of other property. And then sometimes the owner of that property will go look for a publisher because they think a book would be cool or help sell the product. A lot of times publishers are like, oh, you know, Supernatural is an awesome TV show. Let's see if we can get a license to produce some books. And then they approach the IP holder. IP holder says, sure, you're a good company. Pay us X amount of dollars and you can have the license to do three books. And then the editor looks for a writer who will be able to, not just one, probably several, you know, one for each book. And, you know, we pitch ideas. They pick a few. They send them to the studio. The studio approves them. We do an outline. Studio approves that. We do a book. Studio approves that. And then you're done. But it's their original adventures, you know, set in the world of like Star Trek or Star Wars. Sometimes with characters straight out of the movies and TV shows. Other times they might be original characters you invent, but set in that world. And then there are novelizations where you take a movie script and you expand it into a story. Those are tie-ins as well, but it's kind of special because it's almost like a collaboration with someone you'll never meet because you got to use their script as part of your story.
Yeah.
And they're a lot of fun. You go, I've written like action adventure novels, spy novels, things I wouldn't have thought to do on my own, maybe, except it was a tie-in project that came along. Mm-hmm. And it does flex a certain different muscles. It's almost like being an actor where you have a script kind of, or being a director where you have a script and some actors, things to work with. You're still creating, but you're creating within an environment. I guess the closest thing would be like if you were part of a writing staff on a TV show. You know, there's a certain, here's what you have to work with, and you are going to write an episode, but you don't create, you know, maybe some of the smaller characters for that episode, but everything's been created by the series creators, but you're hired to write in just one adventure or whatever. So maybe Italians are like that.
Got it. That makes sense. So how do you even get into that? And what's your advice for people who are listening to this or watching this right now and saying, hey, that sounds interesting. Like I'd love to give a go at that.
Yeah. You know, it's something that's become a lot more respected over the years. And so many people, there's so many interesting media properties out there, and people do so much fan fiction, which is like, you know, unofficial tie-in fiction because you're not licensed to do it, but it's the same kind of thing. The most important thing is to be able to show that you can write novels first, you know, write novels at a professional level. So you do your own stuff. It helps. It doesn't have to be, but it helps if it's traditional publishing, only because you have to work with an editor, which is like what you have to do with tie-ins. It's always through an editor. And then you have to also have to work with the IP holder. So if you can already show that you can work as a team in partnership with people, it's easier if you traditionally publish because you see it. Doesn't mean you can't do it. The most important thing is you finish books and they're good books. Then you can either go ahead and start networking with people who already do tie-ins, you know, like on social media, get to know them a little bit and just ask them, you know, how did they get their gigs? And once you've published a few things, people say, oh, you know, you're a professional. So here's my editor's email. And you email them and you say, I would love to write a tie-in. Do you have any available? And they'll say no. But they'll say, we'll keep you in mind. And that's often how you end up with them. They're like, oh, my God, we need somebody. I remember Tim said he'd do one for us. Let's go say check with Tim. Sometimes if you have an agent, they go to your agent, or your agent can put feelers out to the different publishers and see. So there's like a variety of ways. Sometimes they fall in your lap. Sometimes you go out and look for them. But it all begins with you being able to demonstrate, maybe over the course of at least a couple books, that you can, you know, write a novel from beginning to end and be a good novel, bring it to completion.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Now, how'd you get your first one?
That's a really good question. What was my first one? I think my first one was for a role-playing game called Vampire Dark Ages, the White Wolf put out probably in the early 2000s. I had seen some open anthology calls for like White Wolf anthologies. And so you work in their world. Their world is like, you know, they had a game for vampires and werewolves and all that. So it was like a horror scenario overall. And so I saw that. So I submitted some stories to that and got published. So that means I'd already had a little bit of background in that. And then they saw on their webpage, they were calling for writers. If there aren't, you know, calling for writers, you can find like there's the contact form where on websites where you can just send in like, hey, I'm a novelist. Here's a link to my website. I'd love to do one of these things. It's not easy, but sometimes you can call and maybe somebody, I did that once just to find out about submission processes for Wizards of the Coast because they had an open submission policy, but your submissions kind of disappeared. And so when I called, they were like, oh, well, sorry about that. And they hooked me up with an editor. And I was like, and he's like, you know, we're thinking about doing this young adult version of Dragonlance. Would you like to do that? And I'm like, sure. So a lot of it is just kind of probing, putting out feelers, talking to people. And then once you start doing it, people will start coming to you. And that helps a lot too, because you get known for doing that. Mm-hmm. Some people get pigeonholed. Like there are some people who only end up doing Star Trek books and they might find it a little stifling because they'd like to do their own stuff too. But overall, most people who do it, they really enjoy it. I know I do.
Yeah. Cause who's the main decision makers? Is it the editors? Do you have an agent that's shopping around? Like once that ball gets rolling, like do those just land on your desk and who's kind of making the calls and that sort of thing?
You mean for the tie-ins projects?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's the IP holder.
Got it.
Because they are the one that has the final say on everything. Most of the time, at least for me, you know, if you're already using your common sense and you're like, okay, I can't make Captain Kirk a superhero with a cape. He suddenly gets superpowers and flies around in Star Trek. It just doesn't, you know, it doesn't feel right. And it's kind of silly. If you don't do anything that kind of breaks, you know, the property, they're pretty open for to do everything. But the good thing is that, you know, they see an outline first, and then they can work with you to get the outline the way they want it. And as long as you stick to that for the most part, then you're gold. But yeah, it is, they are the bosses in a way that does not happen with your own work. If you're doing traditional publishing, you are collaborating with an editor. They are not your boss. You know, it is a partnership. But when tie-in stuff, you're a hired hand. And even though they may value your creative input and everything, ultimately they decide.
Got it. And you talked about this earlier, the difference between kind of unlicensed and licensed work. And obviously I would assume that license is working directly with the IP holder and is, you know, that's kind of the process. Unlicensed, tell me about that. Like, is that legal? What are the, like, is that just people who are chasing a trend? Like, how does that work?
Unlicensed stuff are people like fan fiction that people write. Technically it's illegal because they don't own the rights to those characters. Nobody really cares because it's just not worth chasing people down. One of the things that if you find out, like you write an original property you created, and if you find that people are writing fan fiction about it, you have to tell them you don't approve of this and you must stop, because if not, legally you're abandoning your copyright. And so writers, most of whom do not care in the slightest and probably are very flattered that people want to do fan fiction, have to at least publicly say, you know, no, I don't approve of it. They don't have to try to get rid of it or stop it, but it's just a weird legal thing. So, you know, in public, I'm all about, you know, if anybody asks me, no, but in real life, I don't care. I think it's fun for people to do. Yeah. It makes perfect sense. It's kind of how we start off when we play. You know, we like act out our favorite scenes from movies or heroes that we know. We start writing our own stuff, but it's often, you know, sort of like images or reflections of stuff that we've read and enjoyed. And eventually stuff does become public property. Like Winnie the Pooh. That's why there's that Winnie the Pooh slasher movie now, because Winnie the Pooh's in. Finally, the world owns Winnie the Pooh, and we can do whatever we want. Mm-hmm. But yeah, in general, the unlicensed stuff, you know, write it and have fun with it, but don't ever do one on your own and then try to get it published. I've had a couple people email me and say, I've written a supernatural novel, I've written an alien novel, now I want to get it published, and I have to tell them it doesn't work that way. You know, if you're not hired to do it, it's never going to get published. Mm-hmm. The best thing to do is change Alien to another name and, you know, change a few things in it, then publish it as an original work. It can be very close to Alien and still not violate the copyright.
Mm-hmm. Mm, got it. That makes sense. And then last question on the media tie-in stuff, because this is really fascinating. It's something we haven't talked a lot about on the show. What is the finances of that look like? Are they, I mean, I'm assuming they buy the rights, it sounds like, to the media tie-in book, and then they're shopping with writers. They probably cut a royalty back to the IP holder. You as the author, or is it a contract fee? And okay, we're going to pay you once and deliver this work. Do you get a royalty on the long tail of that? What does that look like?
No, it's just straight work for hire. You know, they pay you X amount of dollars to do this job and they're done. And anything that you put in that book, the IP holder owns. Anything that you may have created in there doesn't matter. It's created within their IP. So, So you kind of have to be aware that that's why if you ever watch the Marvel movies, they have like at the end, thanks to all these different artists and writers, but Marvel owns it, so they don't get any money. You know, I know the writer that a lot of the last Black Panther movie came from his run on the comics. He loved to see it, but anybody who works with an IP, you know, going in that, you know, you own nothing. And that's just the nature of the beast, and that's okay.
Got it. Okay. That makes sense. Well, thanks for breaking down all that stuff on media. Sure. It's really, really interesting. Let's talk about, I've got a few more things I want to touch on. So you've got this book, Writing in the Dark. Can you give us what is that process? I'm intrigued about it. What does the book talk about, and kind of what are some of the principles that people can apply for their writing?
Yeah, it's a book on writing horror. It's everything I've learned about writing horror over decades. So it goes into real specifics about how to do it, different ways to think about it. It also, I mean, people could use it for writing anything that might be dark or suspenseful or a thriller, or if you want to have like any kind of dark or suspenseful scenes, like in a fantasy novel or whatever. And then there are, of course, things that in general apply to any kind of fiction. In terms of, you know, how to write with an immersive point of view, or, you know, how do you construct a scene so it's suspenseful and that kind of stuff. But Writing in the Dark was just it's the name of my blog. And I figured, you know, Writing in the Dark, just dark like horror. And then when it came time for this book, the editors were like, yeah, we'll just name it after your blog. And I'm like, okay, it sounds good. So it's not like anything special meaning to the title, other than just, you know, just horror writing.
Yeah. And is this your only work in nonfiction, and then everything else has been fiction, or have you written other nonfiction books as well?
I've done some other ones. I've done a follow-up to Writing in the Dark. It's a workbook that has more exercises than Writing in the Dark did. I got to do a sort of nonfiction book for Supernatural, since Supernatural is all pretend. It's not, but it's supposed to be a manual, like, of the various monsters that the Winchesters encounter, and there's notes from Sam and Dean about it as they're compiling it. So that part was fun, but it's technically nonfiction. And then I have I got another nonfiction writing book coming out where I put in a number of short stories from the, like, when I was 18 all the way up to now, and then I talk about what the inspiration was, and then I critique them afterwards. Like, what would I do differently now? So it's kind of like using my own work as an example to talk about writing principles. I don't know what that one's eventually going to be called or when it's going to be out, but it's in the works. Just in a handful of nonfiction. If you count, my blog's been going on for 10 years, and I've written articles about writing for a long time. But in terms of books, yeah, it's just a few.
Got it. Now, have all of your books been traditionally published, or have any of them been self-published?
I've self-published a short story during one of the first like months of COVID. I got really bored. And so I'm like, you know, a lot of times people will try writing these shorter erotica pieces to self-publish. So I picked a pseudonym and I wrote one with a vampire in it. My wife's an artist. She did the cover. We put it on up, and it was fun to do. And it gave me a chance to see the whole process. So because I teach creative writing, and I want to be able to at least tell my students enough about what that was like. And then one of my small press books, for some reason, when the publisher tried to put up the ebook, they wouldn't let him. They kept rejecting it. So he says, I'll just give it to you and you put it up. And then they accepted it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it hardly counts as self-publishing in terms of a process. I just was like pushing the buttons my publisher couldn't push for some reason. So that's about all I've done. I think sometimes about, you know, I do have books like the Necropolis series you mentioned. People still email me and say, you're going to write some more. I think, you know, I could do that with self-publishing if I wanted to. And it's something I'm thinking about moving toward a little bit. I've noticed a lot of veterans or writers who've been writing for 20, 30 years are moving toward that more, you know, taking control of their own work, publishing their backlist, continuing series on. So it's something I'm thinking of. I got a few years before I retire from my teaching job, so I may move full force into that once I'm done.
Yeah. Now, do you have a publisher that you work with a lot of your books, or how does that kind of process work, especially for publishing so many books?
Yeah, I can work with different ones for different types of books. Just depends. If you are like, you get published by a big enough publisher in traditional publishing, they'll have like a clause that basically says, you know, you don't publish with anybody but them. They say it like they get first look at whatever you're going to do next or whatever. And or your agent may say only one book a year, because that's the way that, you know, you don't oversaturate the market and whatever. And so you're encouraged at that level not to be as prolific as you could be. But when you're publishing with smaller press, or even if it's, you know, mass market, it's not gigantic, you know, super famous publisher, they don't seem to care as much. And if you can sometimes get this weird situation where you have like pre-books come out a month apart, and it's really hard to decide, and you didn't know that was going to happen because nobody told you early on when the pub dates were going to be. And then you have to figure out, how do I promote three books at once? Do I just pick one? You know, what do I do? So it's just different publishers. So right now I may be working with half a dozen, maybe, for different things, stuff coming up that I haven't written yet. Right now, I think it's only one or two at this point. I've got a backlog of things to come out still. So,
got it. If you, when you look at kind of your catalog, are there any attributes or things that you could point to that are commonalities of your best-selling books?
It's hard to predict what they're going to be. You know, if you can catch a wave and ride it, or if it's a wave that goes on long enough. Like for a long time, you know, serial killer thrillers like Silence of the Lambs were really, you know, they just stayed strong. And you'd have enough time to catch that wave and probably write one. But a lot of times the wave comes and goes before you can jump on it. But it seems like the best-selling things usually are stuff that people can, in general, relate to in a broad way, a broad range of people. So if there's going to be like any kind of supernatural element or science fictional element, it's smaller. So it doesn't require so much suspension of disbelief. The writing style tends to be, I think, easier to read. I think the pace is a little faster because that is the way to grab as many people as you can. I mean, that's why newspapers write what they do their stuff on like a sixth grade reading level, not because they think people aren't smarter than sixth grade, but that's because you can read it fast. So I think you can do that. Series works really well. People really like characters that they can get into. It's the thing editors like too. The stereotype of New York editors is they want character more than anything else. And agents too. So if you're writing like an action story with very thin characters, it might be a hard sell for them.
Got it. Are you, you talked about series working really well. One of the big things that Rami Vance or Ari Vance, he runs the fiction, kind of the fiction side of selfpublishing.com. He always talks about the read-through rate and how that read-through rate is so important. What percentage of people who buy book one are going to buy book two and buy book three and four and so on. Is there anything that you do intentionally around that and that you feel like maximizes that read-through rate?
No, not really. A lot of my books are standalone, even though they take place in the same general universe. So having some connections between them, at least for people who've read the other books, and making it clear that it's that way. Like on my blog, I have here's all the different books and how they kind of connect. So that thing can work pretty well. One series I'm doing now, I've done the first one a year ago, and it's time for me to do the second one. But that publisher is going to wait to release them all pretty much about the same time. So I think the biggest thing is just you have your next book ready to go when they finish the first one, because they can just click and get that next one. And that's something traditional publishers, they'll do eventually with a series, but they won't do, you know, starting out traditional publishing, they treat it like the lottery. Yeah, they don't know if you're going to be successful or not. They'll give you some, you know, publicity money a little bit. But once they find out your book is selling, they pour more publicity money into it because it's a more sure return on investment. So even though you're supposed to be like a full partner with them, it doesn't always work out that way. So that's one of the things self-publishers can really control. You know, they can control what they release. They control like trying to maximize people going through their series. You can write smaller books, especially if they're ebooks, because nobody or larger ones, whatever. Nobody cares the physical dimensions because it doesn't matter anymore. So, I mean, just all of that's been a real game changer in the ways that, you know, people can try to maximize how one readers go through one of their books to the second one, to the third one.
Yeah, absolutely. I see a lot of that with, so Rami's created a fundamental of fiction, the fundamentals of fiction and story, and then our full-time fiction kind of two core programs. And he talks a lot about that staggered launch. So exactly. And that's the beauty of self-publishing, right? Is you can stagger. All right, let me sit on some of these and go book one, book two, book three. All right, promote. Then maybe at the 1 year mark, let's put together a box set, like, and just like a lot of kind of tie-ins and things that you can do to then, you know, use that so that people can, like you said, they buy the first one, they want to read the next one. And if the next one's not available, well, then they can't buy it. Right. And so it's just like some of those things to tie the books together.
Yeah. And publishers, they won't take a chance on your original fiction that way, traditional publishers, but they will do tie-in fiction that way because they know there's already a market. So, you know, like, a publisher may get the license to do 5 Alien books. They do exactly what, you know, each month a different one comes out. Year later, they're all put together into an omnibus. So, I mean, that works well. But for publishers, they want more of a sure thing to do that. it is a risk. You know, if you're a self-publisher and you write your three books and they don't take off, it's like, well, that was a year of my life or whatever. Mm. But, you know, you have a much greater chance, I think, of success doing that with a series.
Now, do you have any tips for marketing fiction, for fiction marketing? Any tips or anything that you do that you feel like works well?
You need to find like the people that actually like the thing you're writing. I think a lot of mistakes that writers make is that they try to go broad and they'll take like a weird extreme horror novel full of blood and sex and everything and try to sell it to a general audience. And it's like, that's already a niche audience. Even in the horror community, that's a niche audience. So the more that you can find those people, whoever your audience is, the better. And, you know, social media allows you to do that. You can do it on Amazon with the way you do your tags and everything and your keywords, and you can still refine those as you go. I think cross promotion can work really well. I think that if like several writers who write kind of the same thing sort of cross promote each other's work. So if you have any friends or make connections, I think that works really good. But there's this movie I was showing in my novel writing class last night. It's about a writer's group. I can't remember the title off the top of my head. Now, of course, that I just saw it last night. But at any rate, so one of the characters, he's written like this terrible Tom Clancy knockoff. And his signing he's going to do is in a hardware store because that's where his girlfriend works. And, you know, one of my students is like, he should have just taken it to like a military surplus store. He would have sold a ton of those. And I'm like, yeah. I had a student who he would write humorous stories about hunting dogs because those were his interests, you know, humor and hunting dogs. He would go to like these hunting conventions is where he would sell those books, because you try to sell that in a bookstore, how many people are going to be going, I want humorous stories about hunting dogs. So, you know, I think finding your people who would be interested in this, I think you're much better served to do that than try to go super broad and try to get everybody, you know, to read what you write.
That's great. Tim, this has been awesome. What would be your parting piece of advice for the Tim from a couple decades ago and maybe the other Tims out there who are thinking about writing their first fiction?
I would say the thing I tell my students all the time, that writing is nothing more than psychological endurance if you want to build a career. You just have to keep going. And it's okay to take a break if you need to. It's okay to scale back a little bit or whatever. But it's all up to you to keep going. No harm if you want to quit and you decide that's not for you. That's not a problem. But the other thing I tell people too is that writing is a series of decisions. It's all it is. This story, not that story. This character, not that character. This event, not that event. This word, not that word. And the better you get at making decisions and not second guessing yourself as you're making them, the easier it gets. Because if you spend all your time sitting there going, oh my God, what's the next best word to use? You end up getting stuck, especially if the generation that went through No Child Left Behind, where everything was teach to the test and there is a right answer for everything and you must know it. I find those students have a terrible time making choices because they were taught that there was only one right one and you need to identify it. So I think the more you just make as many choices as you can and then worry about dealing with it later, I think that'll serve you a lot better than worrying about what's the perfect thing to do at each step.
That's so great. That's awesome. Well, Tim, where can people go to buy your books, to find out more about you and what you're up to?
Well, my website, like everybody else, is the best place. It's just timwagoner.com. And Wagoner, you know, I'm assuming you'll have my name somewhere, but you know, it's got two G's and an O, so it's not a common spelling of it. But you go there and it's like, it has links to everything. All my social media, my blog, I have a YouTube channel just where I give all kinds of writing advice. You know, I've got, like everybody else, my own page on Amazon you can find. So really, my website's the best place. It's like the Walmart for me. It's one-stop shopping. You go straight to my website.
Cool. TimWagoner.com. Tim, thank you so much.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I had a great time.
Thank you so much for watching or listening to this episode of the Self-Publishing School Podcast. I know there's so many places that you could be spending your time. There's other podcasts that you could be listening to, YouTube channels that you could be watching. So thank you so much. It means the world. Now, I want you to do three things right now if you found this episode helpful. All right, number one, I don't know if you know this, but we've got a YouTube channel. It's a companion channel to this podcast. All the video versions of the episode are on the YouTube channel. So number one, subscribe to the YouTube channel. Number two, if you're listening to this podcast wherever, whether this is Spotify, Apple Podcasts, number two, I want you to subscribe to this podcast right now so you don't miss a future episode. And then number three, this is probably the most important, leave a review on the podcast. All right, reviews are super important in helping the podcast get discovered by other people. So number three, leave a review on the podcast. Thank you so much. I'll see you in the next episode. If you're on the fence about scheduling a publishing consultation call with my team, maybe you're not quite ready for that, I've got some free training that I think will be really helpful for you. All right, all you have to do is go to register to sign up. Go to selfpublishing.com/free training. When you do, you're also going to get a free digital copy of my new book, Published. And on that training, you're going to learn the next step, so how to implement with your book. So how to write, how to publish, how to launch successfully. So go to register right now at selfpublishing.com/free training. I'll see you there.